Hi, my name's Wayne, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Wayne.
And I'm pleased to be here. I'm pleased to be sober. I'm just pleased to be anywhere. I don't know what it was like for you when you got here, but it was getting a little grim for me, and my life's not like that anymore. I've gone to a lot of AA meetings, and I've never seen one so well organized, with all these guys coming up and giving speeches, and no one went over 10 minutes, I'm really impressed, because I've kind of observed that where two or more alcoholics are gathered, there's a disagreement, and somebody's doing a good job here. I have one kind of political thing to say that's only my own opinion. I'll say it right at the beginning of the meeting, and then everything else I say, I stick pretty close to the book. I noticed there's a lot of newcomers, and a few of them mentioned drugs, quite a few of them. And I work with a lot of newcomers, and a lot of them mention drugs. And sometimes I see newcomers go out because they don't feel part of AA, because they're more into drugs than into alcohol. And what I've been doing with my newcomers and what seems to work well, and I make them understand that I'm purely an alcoholic, although on a daily basis I walk around pilled to the gills, but that I just concentrate on the alcohol. And what I've my conclusion is like all that other stuff, whether it's powder or you inject it or whatever you do it, it's kind of like all freeze-dried alcohol. And if you keep that in mind, the program makes sense and really works for you. As a kid and as an adult and into sobriety, I was the kind of kid that whenever I started something new, I really got involved in it. I took off like a shooting star, and I'd get about halfway through it, and I'd be like a plummeting meteorite coming back. I'd give up on it. I'd get bored with it. I only kind of did everything half-baked, and that was true all through my life. And all of a sudden, I got this program, and I got it, and one day it occurred to me that the reason I probably got this this fellowship and got sober and got comfortable in this thing is that you only have to read half a book. You know, it's I like that. It fit my personality and I don't know. I'm a secretary of a speaker meeting too up in near Laguna in Dana Point, and we had Johnny Harris Friday night, and he's such a polished speaker, and so when I was hearing him speak, I said, I'm going to go home and practice all weekend so I can give you a polished speech. And I went home all weekend and watched basketball. I can't do it. So when I get up here, I don't know what I'm going to say, and it's interesting. Sometimes it comes out fairly well, and sometimes it's awful, so good luck. I came from a real strict family. And my dad was like rags to riches. My mother was a society woman but came from a broken home. And her mom was a raging alcoholic. Granny was just a drunk. There's no other word for it. And basically, I was raised by the two women because it was World War II, and my father was a pilot, and later on he was a pilot for the airlines, and he was gone a lot. So I was raised by kind of like Granny, the wanton woman, and mom, who was terrified that she'd end up like Granny, so she went into perfectionism. She went into looking good, and she went into denial. I was the kind of kid that wanted to please, and I wanted you to like me. I wanted to do whatever was necessary that I would gain acceptance, I would gain attention, I would gain love. But I was a confused kid, and I'd see my parents and other relatives looking down at me, you know, with these expectant faces. And I knew I was supposed to do something, but I never had the slightest idea what it was I was supposed to do. By the time I was six, I kind of pretty well realized that lack of power was my dilemma, and I just continued on like that. I continued on wanting to please, but never having the slightest idea how to please, and I had my first drink when I was 13, and I needed it. I was pretty mad at myself at 13 of why I had waited so long. It made me feel, I don't know if it made me just not care whether I please people anymore, or it made me feel like I was pleasing them. It did something special for me, and I liked it. And from 13 to 18 was probably the slowest, most agonizing years of my life. I could just hardly wait to leave home. I mean, it took forever to turn 18. And my folks had raised me in a very socially prominent family, and I'd gone to a lot of debutante balls, and all my dates were set up by my mother, who was very socially prominent, so I had to go out with all these ugly daughters of their friends, you know, and I hated it. And when it came time to go to college, they wanted to structure where I went to college. They wanted me to either go to Stanford or to someplace back east. I can't think of it right now. But like, you know, Princeton. It was Princeton. And I said, no, I want to play football, and I want to be with the people. I want to go where my friends are. I want to go to Berkeley. And it was 1961. And I came off of a ranch. And I was born and raised in Southern California, but my folks had moved to a ranch outside of Carson City. And so I was a very naive, very overprotected, very immature kid for almost 2 weeks at Berkeley. And then I discovered just like freedom. I discovered kind of like wine, woman, and song all at once. I discovered San Francisco and Barbary Coast days and fraternity parties and staying up all night. And I just loved it. I had a lot of fun. And I really believed that all those terrible feelings that I had inside of me were a result of my upbringing. And that I thought that once I was free, and that once I was in college, and once I knew a little bit about sex and all that, that I was going to be fixed. And I did okay at school. I played a lot of ball. I was in a good fraternity. I did a lot of things right. But I don't know. For some reason, it just didn't quite fix me. I'm not saying I didn't have fun, because I had a lot of fun. But it was like there was a little piece of the puzzle missing. And towards the end of school, I think I was 20 years old, and something wasn't quite right. And I went to San Francisco with a girlfriend of my girlfriend, just to drink, just platonic and everything. And we got real drunk, and we jumped on a Greyhound bus, went to Reno, and got married. And it just kind of seemed like the thing to do. Now, that wasn't exactly a marriage made in heaven, but if you're new, and my story sometimes is, in some areas is a little extreme and you don't identify, perhaps you'll identify with the fact that I was looking to fill that hole in my gut. I was looking to feel like a human being, to feel comfortable in my own skin. So no matter whatever actions I took, that was just my desperate attempts to get comfortable. And if you keep that in mind, maybe you can identify. After college, I decided that my problem was that I had a little independence, but I didn't have any money, and I didn't know when I hadn't made my mark on society. I hadn't made my mark on anything. And if I moved to Southern California, and if I had my own company, and if my girlfriend was a movie star, and I had a big mansion and new cars and places in the mountains, that would fix me, that I'd be whole. And I had that all by the time I was 25, and it didn't fix me, so the best I could come up with is I just got drunk and got married. And time was starting to go by. I was before the end of my 20s, I had lost that movie star and that mansion and that company, and it dawned on me that my problem probably was that I was living in the fast lane of Los Angeles. You know, things were going fast. I was drinking fast. There was fast women. And what I needed to do was move to a little more serene, tranquil place, and I'd be okay. So I moved to Reno, Nevada. And that didn't really fix me too well, so I got drunk and got married. But Reno did show me something. When I was living in Southern California, people would ask me stupid questions. I had been a daily drinker since I was 18. And in Southern California, people would ask you questions like, why did you do it? Why did you get so drunk last night? Why did you do the things you did? Or you'd hear people make comments like, you know, if he just didn't drink so much, he'd be a great guy. They don't mention things like that in Reno. I just found a whole group of people just like me. I mean, they drank and they didn't ask any questions and they didn't want to be asked any questions. And all of a sudden, though, 10 years of my life had gone by. I was 29 years old or 28 and a half or something like that. And it dawned on me I was drinking too much, so I decided to quit. And it's amazing, but the chains that bind us are never felt until it's too late to break them. I tried quitting drinking and I couldn't. And I never knew that up to that point. I always thought I drank because of choice. It was my choice to drink, and all of a sudden when I tried to quit, I found that I could not quit. And I got a little desperate. I went to a doctor, and he gave me Valium. And I tried that, and I ended up in the hospital, OD'd on booze and Valium, you know, and I saw that I couldn't even detox myself with tranquilizers, although I picked up a new habit that I was to keep for a while. So I decided that I'm going to have to get some help. And in Reno in 1970, there weren't all these fancy programs. So I had to call AA. Well, I have to tell you that I had been exposed to AA since the middle 50s because of Granny, the drunk. And when I was 15 years old, when my folks became wealthy later on, they weren't wealthy when I was young, but they became wealthy and they traveled a lot. And Granny was supposed to come over to the house when we were teenagers and just cook for us and keep an eye and make sure we didn't burn the place down. Well, as my folks left the door, Granny would start drinking and pass out on the couch before my folks were out of the driveway. I don't know how she did it, but she was always passed out on that couch as soon as my folks left. And she was real bad one time, so my brother and I went around. We got her purse, all her money out of it. We got every bottle. We locked everything up, and still Granny was passed out on that couch. And every once in a while, she'd get up and pick some flowers, and then all of a sudden she'd be back. And she'd be passed out on that couch. We watched her for 4 or 5 days, you know, and her teeth were turning nice and brown, and we were starting to get a little worried about her, and we just couldn't figure out how in the heck she kept getting so drunk. And it wasn't until later years I found out that she had filled all the flower vases in the whole house with booze, and she was changing them on a daily basis. And I take after my granny, by the way. She's a... But I called AA on Granny that time, and I called him up and I said, you know, about my granny. She's been drinking now for 5 or 6 days, and she really hadn't moved much. And we don't know what to do with her. And they told us at the time, and I distinctly remember the conversation because it made a big impression on me. They said, well, there's nothing we can do until she doesn't drink for 3 days, and then we'll send someone out to help. And I thanked him, and I hung up, and I turned to my brother, and I said, you know, she could stay sober for 3 days. She wouldn't need AA. And it was that kind of thinking I was to carry for a lot of years. And so when it came time for me to get sober, I looked in the phone book under alcoholism or whatever I looked under, and there was only one listing. It was AA. So I had no choice. And I called up AA, and I said, I can't quit drinking, and I need to quit drinking. I didn't say anything about forever. I just wanted to quit, like, for a few days, they said that you have two choices. You can go to the Cracker Factory, or you can come and join us at AA. And I said, well, there's no choices at all. I'll go to the Cracker Factory. And I had my current wife, my current wife, drive me over to the Cracker Factory, and it was a 90-day volunteer program, but I was willing to do it. And they took one look at me, and they put me in the lockdown ward. And I resented that. I said, I decide I want to unvolunteer, and I want to go home now. And they said, no, you're right where you belong. And I said, no, this is a voluntary program. I want to go home. And I lost that little argument, and they strapped me to a table for over 3 days with no medication. And that was my first detox. And I got another little resentment towards doctors and nurses and detox. And it's to play a big part in my story later on. I did so well in the ashtray department that I got out of the lockdown ward in record time. They put me into alcohol recovery, which was a separate building still in the nut house, but you felt a little bit better at this other building. And I started my 90-day program, and I did real well in it. And I did, in fact, I graduated in 60 days, which was unheard of. And I went back to my job. I had managed to work my way down from chemical engineer to bartender at a casino in Reno. And, of course, I went out of the Nut House. Now, I had been exposed again to AA at the Nut House. Now, I don't know what you thought of AA when you got here, before you got here, but my mind was Skid Row. That's what my mind said. Well, when they had an AA meeting at the Nut House, two guys showed up. Neither one of them owned socks, but they owned a lot of other clothes, and they were wearing them all. What? One guy had no teeth, and the other guy had three teeth, and he was very proud of them. I didn't get the message, you know. I understand it's a program of attraction, and it wasn't for me. So I went back to tending bar in the casino, and I was to stay sober 7 months. The first 5 months, I think it was because for the first time since I was 18 years old or 17 years old, I was clean, and physically I felt so good just to be clean that I stayed sober on that. But the last 2 months, I started going insane, and I didn't know what to do, so I got drunk and got married. And there's an act up in Reno. It was Pat Collins, hypnotist, but she also had a private practice, and it dawned on me, this is a very keen mind, that if I went to a hypnotist, I could quit this drinking, skip that detox thing that I'm scared to death of, and she could kind of program me to where I could get everything under control. And it was a brilliant idea. The only problem is, I don't know about you, but when I drink a lot, and every time she'd get me on the threshold of deep hypnosis, I'd just pass out on her. And it would take her hours to get me awake. So that didn't work either, so I just got drunk and got married again. I didn't know what else to do. And then I tried several different times, but basically I decided to try religion. I had gone with Granny, the drunk, to some of these different churches. She would go in and out of AA, and when she was out of AA, she was over with the Holy Rollers. And I don't mean a nice organized religion, I mean Holy Rollers. And I was sprayed and sprinkled and dipped and dunked and bewildered by religion, you know. And one of the last ones I found myself at was the First Samoan Assembly of God. And I just didn't feel part of. And it didn't work for me, and I had all these wedding rings, so I just got drunk and got married. It was about this time I was in, my drinking was kind of like 95% of the time I was couch potato, and then 5% of the time I would drink and I would go absolutely insane. God knows what I'd do. And I was going through one of my couch potato phases, and that necessitates a lot of television. And there was tons of ads starting to come on the TV about Upchuck Hills and some of these other places. And when I used to see them at first, I'd get real nervous, and I'd make noise or sing or crinkle paper or anything not to hear them, because I had a little guilt about it. But all of a sudden, I was looking at it, and, I mean, they guaranteed a miracle cure, and it was 2 weeks with four two-day follow-ups or something. I don't know. And the closest one was in San Francisco, and I said, well, that's for me. I mean, 2 weeks, and I'm cured. And so Upchuck Hills taught me one thing. I was to go there 7 times before it dawned on me that not only am I a slow learner, but I had been throwing up for years. And, I mean, it just had no effect on me whatsoever. And Upchuck Hills didn't work for me, so I just got drunk and got married. What's a guy to do? It was about that time that I had had a little problem. I was a morning drinker. I drank when I was awake. So, I mean, it's kind of ludicrous to say a morning drinker whenever I happen to be. You know, sometimes my mornings were at night because I got things a little screwed up. But I was having a a little trouble keeping jobs and wives. And I had a few friends because most of the time I was fun to be around. Not always, but most of the time. And they cared about me. And they said, Wayne, you know, all you're doing is drinking and chasing women. You can't even hold a decent job. You're going to end up in Skid Row. Well, I mean, I resented that. I didn't say anything. But inside, I mean, I said, that's not the way my life is supposed to be. There's got to be something for me. If I think, I can think of it. Now, I like to drink and chase women. What can I do and be a success? And it dawned on me one more time. I got a job as a graveyard bartender in a whorehouse. And and I was to keep that job for a year and a half until I ran away with some of the help. And it was starting to trickle through up here that my life was becoming a tad bit unmanageable. But I didn't know what to do about it. My only solution, besides drinking, is when it got too tough for me out there, I wanted to go to Mexico. Because I just felt free in Mexico. I could drink all I wanted. I got arrested on a regular basis, but I was always able to pay. I felt comfortable drinking in Mexico. They weren't out to get me as much as they were here. But I usually decided to go to Mexico about 2 in the morning. You know, I don't decide I don't know if normal people decide to go to Mexico because it's too tough. But I had reduced myself now from being a bartender in a casino. I had gone through that, and then a bartender in a cowboy joint, and then a bartender in a Skid Row joint, and then unemployable, but I was able to get a job as a cab driver. And it was interesting, drinking and driving a cab. I did it for a lot of years, and it was interesting. But I decided about 3 in the morning that I wanted to go to Mexico. And I had a job. I had money in the bank. I even had a checking account. I probably had a wife. I don't know. I usually had a wife. And I had had a nippy poo, but I was walking. And I decided to go to the casino and cash a check. And I went in, and I wrote out a check, and it was good for once. And I gave it to her, and she was most ungracious. She said, not only is your check illegible, but you're drunk. Just get out of here. And one of those 5% times happened. I walked about 10 feet away, and I got enveloped in rage. I just came unglued. I went totally insane. And I said to myself, self, I'm just going to take the money because I got to get out of here. I'm going crazy. I have got to get out of here. And I decided to write a robbery note and rob them. And made sense to me. And I looked high and low for a place, you know, a piece of paper to write a robbery note on. I hadn't come prepared. And I wrote one on a keynote ticket, but you couldn't read the damn thing. There was numbers all over it, and I didn't know what to do. I knew I needed the money, and I knew I needed to get out of town, and I thought and thought, and finally it dawned on me. I wrote the robbery note on the back of my personal check. And finally, I had found a solution for my drinking. I was to get nearly over 3 years of sobriety, and then they let me out. It was a serious charge, of course it was, but it was fairly obvious that it wasn't a well-planned deal. Unfortunately, my best friend was my attorney. That's not unfortunate, except you know that if he is my best friend, besides being an attorney, he's a drunk. We decided to meet at 6 a.m. every morning before trial at the Telephone Booth Saloon and plan our defense. By the time 10 o'clock came and it was courtroom time, we sat there like little robots holding onto the table, looking straight ahead, afraid I was going to fall. I was afraid I'd fall off the chair. We never did present a defense. And when it came to sentencing, the judge said, in my 30 years on the bench, I have never in my life ever seen a person so unconcerned with a trial as I have just now. And he was to say that we're charging you with armed robbery. He said this is one of the briefer trials we've ever had, but I want you to know it's serious. I want you to do 2 years in prison. And since I had put on the note, another brilliant brainstorm, that I was armed, which I wasn't, I got another 2 years for that. So I had 4 years to do, which really equates to doing 2 years in prison. I'm going out of the courtroom, and how many times have I been married up to then? Seven? We got some ways to go. And my attorney yelled out and said, "Wayne, don't even change your clothes. I'll have you out this afternoon." 60 or 70 days later, the other prisoners were hoping I'd change my clothes soon. And I did get out, though, quickly. I got out on appeal bond within 4 or 5 months out of a maximum security prison in Nevada, and I was starting to get the hint that maybe my life was unmanageable. Not bad, but it was getting a little rough around the edges, and I decided to clean up, straighten up. I didn't decide to go to AA. I think that's a little radical, but I decided to stop drinking, get a straight job, and live the good life. And I heard about a job as a brakeman on the railroad, and there were 600 guys applying for it, and there were 7 positions, and I worked my butt off getting that job, and I did get it, and I worked one day. And some x-rays came back, and I had an old football injury to my back, and they had to fire me. And I went into depression. I mean, I had really tried to straighten up, and I hadn't drank, and I'd done everything you're supposed to do, and I'd become a good family man. I did PTA and Little League, and I was just scared. You know, I was doing whatever I thought was necessary for to get a break in life. And being of no particular moral fiber and being depressed, I just went back with my new friends that I had met in prison. They were out now, and we went off in the sunset. I decided to run away. I decided to jump bail and just make a run for it. But being my friends, they were all alcoholics one more time. And, of course, we drank our way all the way to Las Vegas. That's as far as we ever got. And we ran out of money, which is easy to do in Nevada. And I was involved in a real armed robbery there, and a terrible police chase and all kinds of things. And I wasn't exactly the ringleader in this deal, but I knew what was going on, and I was just as guilty even if I didn't perform all the acts. And all of a sudden, I was in a Clark County jail, and I had, you know, worked a 4-year sentence and no prior criminal record of any kind into 34 years. And I'd managed to do that in 18 months. I went from no record to 5 felonies. And I was resigned. I kind of had a deep gut feeling that I needed to be off the street because I was going to hurt somebody or or hurt myself. But, I mean, I just knew I was out of control, and I kind of went to just go do the time. You know, I didn't moan and groan about it too much. I just kind of resigned, and it was kind of like the solution was given to me. At least I know where I'm supposed to go and what I'm supposed to do, and I don't have to even think anymore. And an amazing thing happened. When I went back to prison, in Nevada State Prison, I prefer to call it God's intervention, but you can call it coincidence, you can call it blind luck, whatever. They started me on my wrong sentence. They started me on my last sentence first, and by state statutes that wiped out 24 years of my sentence the first day I was there. And so I ended up having to do one 10-year sentence, and at that time you had to do 1/4 time, so I had to do at least 2.5 years. And I was to do a little over 3, and I got out of prison, and I wanted good for myself. I was amazed that a guy that with my upbringing and with my education and knowing right from wrong could have gotten into that kind of trouble. And I decided that I had had enough in Nevada, and Nevada kind of agreed, and that's one of the reasons they let me out if they promised I'd come back here to the Weirdoville in L.A., and I promptly agreed with them, and I took a bus from Carson City down to L.A., and it was December 12, 1980. I didn't want to drink, but I was lonely, and I was scared, and the person I was supposed to meet for a job never showed up. There was no real excuses. What really went on in the back of my mind is I haven't had a drink, or if I have, it was a couple of beers, but basically I haven't drank for 3 years. I've been eating good. I've been working out. I've been basically really healthier than I've ever been in my life, I can drink. From December 12th, December 27th, I was flat on my back, worse than I'd ever been in my life at LAUSC Charity Hospital. Sicker than I had ever been in my life. I was afraid to show up for parole because I was drinking. I was in a lot of trouble. I had 7 more years, or a little less than 7 years, to do on my sentence. I didn't know what in the heck to do. The parole board had a good idea what I should do, and that's show up. They got word to me somehow, and I showed up for parole about a month and a half late. And I had these clauses when I got out of prison. They said I had a no-drinking clause, and if I was caught drinking, I automatically went back to prison. I also had an alcohol rehabilitation clause, whatever that is, and it meant that I had to go to some kind of program. Well, I finally show up for parole, and another miracle in my life. I mean, who do I get as a parole officer? I get a guy with 17 years on the program of AA. And he shows me this list, 20 different programs I can go for alcohol rehabilitation. And I'm looking at it, and he said kind of casually, you know, if you really want to please your parole officer, you'll go to AA. I just kind of said, well, show me the way, you know. He said, there just happens to be a meeting on Atlantic Boulevard in Alhambra tonight, a speaker meeting. It was a Thursday night. And I really went to, as far as I'm concerned, my first AA meeting. Even though I'd been to AA meetings before, I'd never even bothered to listen. I mean, I went with some idea of helping myself. I didn't know what AA was. I don't pretend that I did, but I just, there was some hope there, but I was scared of it. I was afraid of it, and also I still had the vision of the winos. I went to this meeting, and it's not as big as this, but it's a pretty big meeting. It's an old-time Southern California meeting, and I was sitting in the back row looking real cool, and I want you to understand I'm less than 2 months out of prison, and before the meeting's even started, this little redhead comes bouncing up. She says, I got a year on the program, and I can show you an easier, softer way. And one more time I said, let's go. And unfortunately, she was a blackout drinker, and she got drunk about every 3 weeks, and she didn't remember it, and she thought she had a year. And and my first exposure to AA didn't work real well. But something did happen there. I stayed sober probably 4 or 5 months. I'm not real sure in there. That was a real rough period of my life. And I worked, and I did a lot of things. And I went to a few meetings. I had a couple of problems. One is I was prone to hit you. Another one is I didn't talk. And the other one is I didn't smell good. Even when I didn't drink, I just sweat all the time. And I wasn't one of the ones, I was unhuggable. I was just unhuggable, you know. I'd watch this gal go out, and I'd keep going to meetings holier than thou, and then I'd decide that I'll show her, and I'd get drunk at her, and oh, it was a mess. And finally, I got rid of her, and I went to Raleigh Hills, up Chuck Hills, for my 7th time. And I met a psychologist there. And that psychologist said, Wayne, this is your 22nd detox, your 22nd program, and you're going to die. She said, it might cost me my job, but she was the head psychologist for 11 or 12 hospitals. She says, but I'm a 10-year member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't belong in this expensive hospital program. You belong in AA. And I said, I can't go to AA. One of my biggest problems is they use this word God, and every time I hear it, I want to scream out the back door. And she, in her best professional voice, said, Wayne, you're full of horse pucky. That's not the word she used, but it was something like that. And for some reason, it impresses me when people talk to me like that. They don't mince words. They say, Wayne, you're full of shit. I listened. I said, okay, I'll try it again. They detoxed me, and I went back, and I stayed sober 11 months, I moved down to the beach, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I enjoyed the meetings. I had a lot of fun, and I did the first 3 steps, and I had a roommate that was in AA, but I still had that problem. I couldn't let you know where I was coming from. I couldn't let you know how badly I hurt. I couldn't let you see that kind of anger that I was feeling inside of me. And after 10 months of it, I was starting to take everybody else's inventory. I was starting to see what was wrong with AA. I was starting to go insane is what I was starting to do. And at 11 months, or a little less than 11 months, I made a conscious decision to go out and get drunk and find her, because she could fix me. And I went into a blackout kind of drinking, and I didn't blackout very often, but I went into a blackout drinking, and I woke up about 2 weeks later next to one of the biggest white objects I had ever seen in my life. And even worse than that is she had a brand new wedding ring on her hand. And so did I. And insult to injury, there was a policewoman's uniform hanging on the bedroom door. And she slept with her gun. I called the psychologist immediately. And I told her that my life was unmanageable. But there was no more insurance. There was no more money. There was no more Mr. Big Shot. There was no more hope in my life. She said, Wayne, I cannot get you in another hospital program. I cannot get you a medical detox. The only thing I can do for you is get you into a social detox, a county program. And the one I know about that I can get you in is called Casa del Cerro in Dana Point, California. And I hemmed and hawed and thanked her and hung up, because as much as I wanted to quit drinking, my fear of detoxing was so great without the pills and the frills that I didn't know if I was willing to do it. And I went back to that marriage made in heaven for one more week and watched her strap her gun on every morning. And I realized I had had enough. I just and I called her back and I said, I'll do it. Just set it up and I knew where the place was, because when I'd been in AA before there, I'd been a speaker there, you know, so I certainly knew where the place was, and I was living in Newport at the time, and I had a car of sorts. I had a little problem with possessions. I lost them a lot, but I did have a car, but I was afraid to drive, so I took the bus down PCH and got off at Del Obispo, and if you turn left, you go a little ways, then up this hill, and you're at Casa del Cerro. I turned right, and you go right into a liquor store, and that's what I did. Because I was afraid to go up there. I had too much fear. I couldn't handle it. And I bought a six-pack of beer, and I walked out. There's a state park there called Doheny. And I took that six-pack out there, and I sat at a picnic table, and I drank three of them real fast, trying to get up enough nerve to go turn myself in one more time. I didn't feel any differently. In fact, I felt like it was almost like a waste of time, but I was so sick that I had to, you know, do something to stop. But I didn't see me stopping forever. I just had gone on and on and on, and I'd given up hope. And something unusual happened there. As I was finishing up the third beer, it occurred to me that when I was a kid, like 12 years old, or however old you are when you're a Boy Scout, I had been a Boy Scout right there at that park, right there in that area, I mean that very area, and camped out for 4 days. And I'd been a kid that loved nature, and I'd been a kid full of hope, and I'd been a kid, you know, that thought he had a shot in life. And I realized I was sitting there right now as a derelict, just absolutely worthless. And I couldn't figure out how I got from that kid to that derelict, because it wasn't my intention to do those things. My intentions were to come out and be a normal person and make my, you know, have a happy life. I didn't know how I did it, but something happened. I was too hard-headed to say I surrender. I was too hard-headed to even figure it out, too dumb or whatever I was. But I feel like I was surrendered right then. I just gave up. I didn't drink the other three beers. I said, it's time. I give up. I've had it. It is enough. And I don't care what happens to me. As long as it's different from what's happening to me now, I'll go with it. And I walked up that hill. And I'm not saying I wasn't full of fear. And I'm not saying I wasn't full of anger, because I was. I had a glare in my eyes. I mean, I just looked like I wanted to hurt you. And I did. And I walked up, and thank God there was enough love in that room that they stuck their hand out to me. And they hugged me. And they said I was welcome. Well, people had not lately been saying that to me. And I was welcome. I knew it. I knew something was different. I knew that, you know, when you talk to a psychiatrist, I don't know if you've ever had that problem, but I've talked to psychiatrists and psychologists and to And I don't mean to knock anybody, but I've talked to religious people, and I've once in a while tried to get honest and tell them where I was coming from. Not often, but once in a while. And I'd tell them what was happening, how I was feeling, and I'd look in their eyes, and I could tell they didn't understand what I was saying. But at AA, when I once in a while would get honest and say how I felt, I could see in their eyes they knew where I was coming from. And that was the whole difference at the CASA. I could tell they knew I was hurting, and I could tell that they didn't think anything was wrong with that, and I could tell they understood why I was hurting. And that's about as far as my intellect went. And I stayed up there 7 days. I probably should have stayed for recovery because I was very, very sick. But I'm an independent son of a gun, and I knew that I wanted to get back, and I wanted to get to work. I wanted to get that job again. I wanted to get that car. I wanted to get that apartment. I wanted to get my life in order. And 7 days was enough. And but luckily, the people in Laguna Beach had gotten to know me, and they grabbed a hold of me. And one guy said, they had known that in Sunset Beach, I tried to do a fourth step. And every time I came close to looking at my past, I got drunk, or I went insane, I went nuts. I could not look at it. I couldn't bear to uncover that all that garbage I had done. I couldn't bear to look at those feelings. And every time I approached it, I backed off, and I'd disappear. And this guy, I don't think I had 30 days sober. And I've heard a lot of controversy about this, but it doesn't matter because this worked for me. He said, come on down to the house and have a cup of coffee Sunday morning, 10 o'clock. I said, okay. I was not used to being invited anywhere. You asked me anywhere, I would have gone because this felt good. And so I show up in Laguna Niguel, 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and I walk in the door, and they say, Wayne, sit down, stupid. Okay. And I sat down, and they said, here's a bunch of papers. Divide it up in three columns. You're doing your fourth step right now and your fifth step. And I said, okay. I didn't have time to lie, and I didn't have time to run. I just let it go. Now, that won't work for everybody, and I know it won't, but for me at that time, it just flowed out. I mean, it all went. And I had a feeling so cold inside me that I thought I'd freeze to death. I was shivering. I felt so cold inside. But it all went. I knew it went. It was gone. And that gave me the gift of another 2 years of sobriety where I still had a lot of other problems. One is I still didn't talk. And the other one is I wanted to hit you. Other things happened to me. At 30 days sober, I was asked to speak at a woman's recovery home up in Santa Ana called The Villa. They said, come on up. A gal I'd gotten sober with said, come on up and share your stupid story. And that morning, I'd been kicked out of the apartment I was living with. This might come as a shock, but I was living with a woman, and she couldn't stand me sober. And then I had my car still. I was supposed to pick up a guy with 18 years in the program. He didn't show up. I had no money, no job, no place to go. And about three blocks from where I was supposed to go to this meeting, I was in a head-on collision. My car was destroyed, and my head, but that's the least damageable part, so it didn't matter about that. And I got out of that accident. I was bloody, but not exaggerating, not bad. You know, big bump on my head, and I walked right to the Villa and shared. Now, I look back at that at 30 days, why I didn't walk the other direction to downtown Santa Ana and get drunk, as I've done every time in my life when you have that kind of a day, I don't know. But I know it wasn't my conscious decision, and that's what happened. And then at 90 days, I was almost capable of working. So they recommended that I get a job, this big shot, that required the IQ of a fern. And I did it. Okay, I'll get a job that requires the IQ of a fern. Not only that, we want you to keep it for 1 year. I said, okay. So I got a job as a cab driver. I knew how to do that, and all my friends were there out in the street, you know, the people that still work the streets. And for 6 months, it was great, because driving a cab, you can go to the meetings you want to, you can get in and out, you can do anything you want. And so I went to tons of meetings, and I was driving everywhere. But after 6 months, I was getting well. And I knew that with this keen and cunning mind, I should be doing something else. And I started to bitch and bitch and bitch about this job to my sponsor, who had an extremely deaf ear. And I couldn't understand why I was doing it. I couldn't see the reason I'm well now. And you still, I got to go work 12 hours a day driving this cab, barely subsisting. Why? And I drove, and I drove. And for a year and 3 months, I drove that cab and went to meetings, and that's all I did. And one day in Newport Beach, I picked up this guy from Texas. He said, take me to the airport. Well, we got an airport in Orange County there. It's about 7 miles from where I picked this guy up. And I said, which? Your style. You didn't lie to me, but you sold me on the idea of going to LAX. I'm from Texas. I don't know anybody in California. You want a job? I couldn't believe it. I said, I had to check with my folks. My folks. I'm 39 years old, right? I got to check with my folks. So I went to my sponsor and I said, I've done what you said. And I had a secret thought that he wasn't real bright, but I kept it to myself. And I said, I've been offered a job driving a cab. Can I have it? He said, well, what's the salary? I said, oh, there's no salary. It's commission only. And he said, you know, you can have it. You know why? Because you were doing what you were supposed to be doing, and that job came to you. You didn't go scratching around making that job. So it's probably going to work out for you. And I started this, I met this guy that, I started this company. And I had no employees and no contracts, nothing. It was a brand new company. And I started, doing okay. And the guy I was in partners with was in Texas. Well, 3 months into this company, he was indicted for bank fraud with 12 banks. And all of a sudden, I'm running this company, and he's out of the picture. And the investors come to me. They fly me out to Texas. I fly in. I've just been a cab driver. I fly out on this jet. They come by and pick me up right next to the jet in the helicopter and fly me to their corporate headquarters. Said, we don't know anybody in California either. We want you to run this company. We want this company to be yours. I don't know. I still own that company today, and it's very successful. And it's completely due to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't understand it. I don't get it. But it works. It's I started out with a job, IQ of a fern, and it ended up really doing very close to what I'd been trained to do, but had long since left behind. And I did it without, the only effort was it was showing up. That was it. No manipulation whatsoever. And I've that guy trusts me. And I've pretty much told him the truth about me. I have kind of backed off on the armed robbery part so far. But I don't know if he'd mind it because we're in the vending machine business. And, if you're in that business, your name's supposed to be Rocco anyway, so what the heck. And all of a sudden I own this company and we're brand new. We're 7, 8 months old. We're going great. And all of a sudden we start getting robbed. I mean, on a daily basis. I run the company out of my house. I'm trying to save money, trying to build a company. On a daily basis, some police department's calling me and saying, one of your machines has been robbed in this town. The next morning, 5 a.m. or 6 a.m., a machine's been robbed in this town. And it went on for 9 or 10 months. 3, 4, 5 phone calls a day, morning, noon, night. Police departments are calling me, and I'm going insane. I'm 40 years old. I finally have a chance to make it in life. I'm going to meetings. I'm doing everything I can think of to do things right, and it's all getting taken away from me. I go to police departments, and because they're individual thefts in different jurisdictions, they're just petty thefts. But all of a sudden, $100,000 had been stolen, and they didn't look petty to me. And I was going nuts again. I was going nuts. I was watching my dreams go away. And one night in front of a meeting, I said to my sponsor, I said, I don't know if I can handle it. I don't know if I can take this pressure. And he looked at me and he said, Wayne, you just might have to give it up. And I said, oh my God, he's lost his last wing nut. You know? I couldn't believe he said it. I mean, doesn't the idiot know that this is it? I won't get another chance? You know, doesn't he know that I've poured my life into it? How can I give it up? But everything my sponsors asked me to do, I made an agreement with myself that I will do anything my sponsor asks until it stops working. And unfortunately, well, fortunately, really, he's never been wrong. So I've never stopped doing anything he's asked. I went home, and on a nightly basis for 10 nights, I prayed for the willingness to give up that company. And I got that willingness. And, of course, the magic of the program worked. Once I was willing to give up the company, I was able to endure the thefts. And so I didn't have to give up the company. It took the power out of those thefts. And the energy I
put into worrying about the thefts, I turned into hiring private detectives and catching the guys, which we did, you know. And one more time, my thinking is to buy a gun and get the guys, because we knew who was doing it, we just couldn't prove it. But the program, and me following the program, out of just like blind little robot, yes sir, it worked, you know. And it's just so amazing. And I have to talk a little bit about religion, because it was the hardest thing that I had to, it was the hardest part for me to face, that G-O-D word. And my sponsor one more time talked to me. I said, you know, I can't buy this God concept. I just can't. My dad was an atheist. I can't buy it. I don't know what you people are talking about. You know, I don't see how there could be a God. I just, not with the life I led, not with the way I felt. And my sponsor said, Wayne, God's existence does not depend upon your acceptance of it. That's when I try to look real pensive and like I'm listening to my sponsor. I think he's nuts, but it really... And then he said, in fact, God is just testy enough to go ahead and be anything he wants to be, no matter what you think. I thought, oh boy. And other phrases like that started coming through, and I learned that... You know, like spirituality wasn't a mental exercise. It's something you lived. And I started learning. I started understanding. And also, I started realizing. It was pointed out to me that my folks and doctors and psychiatrists and friends had poured so much effort into trying to sober me up. How many hospital programs? How much effort to sober me up? Absolutely to no avail. I wander into the halls of AA, and I'm struck sober. You know? What else could it be? Because my best efforts didn't make it. And it started to dawn on me there had to be a higher power. And I started thinking about how did all those years on that prison sentence go away, and how did I get that 17-year member of AA as my parole officer? Most of them aren't in AA. Most of them need AA. And I know there's a guy there from the probation department. And you know, I came to believe, and at first my concept had to be Mother Nature. That's all I could. I understood that. I knew I couldn't turn back the tide. I knew I couldn't change the wind. I knew it was more powerful than me. And as time has gone by, and as I become more active in AA, I think my concept's a lot like a lot of people I know in AA, and I'm grateful for it. God, it's given me so much relief. I still had one more problem. I couldn't talk. I was the kid that in grammar school, if it was day for book report, I didn't show up for school. I could not talk in front of a group of people. And the last time I did was in the second grade, and I wet my pants, and I never did it again. I mean, forget it. It made me too nervous. And 2 years had gone by, and I had done my fourth step. I'd done a lot of the steps, but I didn't share in meetings. I didn't talk. I still was kind of in that mode that, as a cab driver, my first year, if somebody touched me or gave me a hard time, we were in a fight. That's the way I handled that, worked my program, worked my anger. And I wasn't a whole bunch better the second year, although I'd stop getting physical. I'd just glare at you, you know. Or, you know, if you were really bad, I wouldn't talk to you anymore. And I was starting to get in a lot of pain at 2 years sober. I was starting to get in a lot of pain. I did not want to drink. And I don't know if I would have, because I don't really didn't want to drink. But I also didn't want this pain I was getting into, because the good feelings I had had as far as I'd gone were wearing thin. I had to take more action. I had to get more involved. And I decided that if I don't start sharing, and I knew what you were supposed to do in AA, if I didn't start sharing my experience, strength, and hope, and I don't mean from a podium, I mean just in a regular participation meeting, if I didn't start being a secretary or a treasurer or cleaning ashtrays or just getting active and volunteering, that I was going to have a miserable life. I knew that. So I decided that I was going to make a total all-out effort. But with my personality, I didn't want anybody locally in Laguna Beach to know that I was going to try. So I found out about a convention in Colorado. And I made reservations, and I went up there, and I volunteered for everything. I mean, they have green shirts up there that show you where to go and tell you what time the meetings are and have to talk to everybody. And I did that, and I volunteered to be a leader and to clean up and to fold tables. And I mean, I just, for 4 days straight, I did nothing but volunteer my help. And I came back to Laguna Beach, and I didn't feel too much different, you know, but something happened. Because the people that, everybody is always nice to me in AA. I never had a problem with that. But all of a sudden, I started getting asked to do things. Something had changed that they could see, that I was ready. It was time for me. And I was asked to be secretary, and I was asked to do this and that. And I was asked to take a meeting to a detox center. And it just went on and on, the things I was asked to do. And also, I was asked to speak at a convention. Bear in mind, I had never spoken. And this guy said, will you be the opening 10-minute speaker at the Orange County Convention? And it was 5 months away or 4 months away or something, so I said yes. I always say yes when it's a long ways away because I never think it's going to get there. And the very first time I talked in AA, like from a podium, it was in front of 3,500 people. And I was scared. I was terrified, you know. But this is a guy that couldn't go to grammar school to make a book report. And one more time, the program worked for me. One more time, what really happened is, yeah, the program worked for me. One of my best friends, I was sitting next to the mayor of Anaheim, you know, and he was making me nervous, too. Everybody was making me nervous. One of my best friends walked by in front of all these 3,500 people, and they couldn't see him because he turned his back, but he gave me the finger just before I was supposed to speak. I don't know. It just loosened me up or something. But I just went ahead and did it. And that's nothing to be proud of as far as giving a talk. What the miracle is the ability to stay up there and not run. You know, to hang in there and do it. It didn't matter if it was in front of 15 people or 3,500 people. I don't think that really matters. But AA gave me the strength, and it was purely AA, gave me the strength to go ahead and do something that terrified me. I mean, terrified me to my toes. Speaking still is hard, and I'm doing a little more of it, but it's something, one of my greatest fears. It's greater than my fear of height. I mean, I just, it was a terrifying thing. And I started, then I was told, work with newcomers. And my feeling was that I'm not worthwhile working with newcomers. You know, I'm still sick as a dog. I'm still going around with feelings like hurting people. I'm still, I can't talk in meetings. When the heck am I going to share with a newcomer? And one more time, my sponsor says, do you know how to stay sober one day? And I said, yeah. He said, then you can share with a newcomer. Go find one that's having trouble staying sober one day. And I started doing that. And I found the true relief in this program. I had done almost everything else. And finally, I started working with newcomers. And my head said, I don't have enough time to work with newcomers. How in the heck can you work with newcomers? I got this company going. I was so happy I was sober. I got married after 2 months of sobriety. I had a family. I was a busy guy. Where am I going to get this time? I go to a meeting every day, at least one, probably about 10 a week. I don't see where I can fit anybody in. And that's another fallacy I found in AA, that the more time that I put into AA, the more effort I put into AA, the more time I seem to have. My life becomes more organized. But my time becomes, there's more quality to my time. I used to spend a lot of time, I'm kind of like a, kind of like a mass of obsessions and kind of hurtling directionless through life, you know. And all of a sudden, I had some direction to my life. And I had more time to do things. And I started working with these newcomers. Some of them liked me, you know. And I started working with more and more of them. I started working in detox houses. And the discomfort I had from speaking and the discomfort I just generally had melted away. Not overnight, but it melted away. Where, with the exception of speaking from podiums and things, I am just genuinely comfortable day in, day out. I have bad days, but I'm still comfortable with Wayne. I'm just having a bad day. It's not all Wayne's fault. Sometimes it is Wayne's fault because his head gets in there. But generally, I just feel okay, and also I know what to do when Wayne gets busy and shuts out the program. And it was just amazing. And I want to share with you, talking about speaking again, when I first started that company, it was necessary to use the telephone. And I hadn't used the telephone in years. It terrified me. And I had to make sales calls, and I couldn't see anyone face-to-face because I couldn't talk. And that's, of course, why I wanted to be a salesman. And so what I did is I would go to a meeting and get kind of centered in an AA meeting, and I would run home and get on the telephone and start making sales call. And the first time I did it, I lasted 15 minutes, and I had to go back to an Alano club. And the next time, and I'd get nice and centered at the Alano club, I'd run home and make some phone calls, and I lasted maybe 25 minutes. And that's the way I started that company, in pure, pure fear. And that fear has left me, and it's this fellowship. I can't tell you how incredible it is. I can't tell you what it's done for me. And I know that feeling. I work with a lot of people that slipped. When I got here, it was 23 detoxes, it was 9 wives, it was 22 stepkids, my God. And I always like prefab families, that way it's a lot less effort. And, you know, it was prison, and it was just total failure. I had lived for years, you know, with a daily recognition of total failure, and I hated it. And I know when a guy, and I talk to a guy, and he says, yeah, I can see AA working for you, but it's not going to work for me. And I know those feelings. And I love working with those kind of guys because you can make it. And I think that all we have to do if we're really hurting is on a daily basis go to a meeting and stick your hand out and say, hi, my name's Wayne and I'm an alcoholic. I think the rest of the magic of the program will take over from there. You don't have to say you're hurting. Usually we can tell. You don't even have to say you're new. We can usually tell that too, you know. And it's an incredible program. I've gotten so much out of it, and the only reason I get, the more I give, the more I get. And everything that I've heard has been true. My sponsor didn't lose his last wing nut. He's an incredible guy, and he loves me no matter what I am that day. And I've learned unconditional love, and I've learned a lot of other things. Last night I went to a meeting that was just for couples, and everybody's talking about how they quit coffee and how they quit, they started dieting or they quit this or cigarettes. All of a sudden it dawned on me that we're spending all this energy quitting our obsessions, and that really once more and more time we're getting rid of symptoms. You know, it's just like getting rid of alcohol. We're only getting rid of a symptom. The problem is in here. And I started realizing that when we work a real good program, and I started thinking about my obsessions, a lot of them just melted away by having some balance, but by starting to love myself. You know, I started not having to have those obsessions. And it's just amazing what this program's done for me. I love it. And I love you. And I don't have any more to say, so I thank you.